Merriam-Webster defines it as the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of another. The definition of empathy goes on from there, but essentially what dictionaries are telling us is that it's this capacity to understand and share the feelings of someone else. And the word itself has only been around for a century. A new book explores the shift in how we perceive empathy as a skill, something that's marketable. We're exploring empathy, how we learn it, how we live it isn't in our DNA. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chris Beam is an assistant professor of English at William Patterson University. Her newest book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, empathy is one of the words that sounds really good, and yet I'd imagine that if you got a lot of people in a room and asked them to define empathy, you'd get, you know, unique responses in every case. So let's start there. Why is empathy a hard concept to pin down?
You know, that's a really interesting question. You know, I think everybody experientially has a different sort of feeling about it. So some people feel empathically really differently when they're experiencing another person's experience. So some people feel things very intensely when they're with another person, and some people don't feel it at all. And so they feel like empathy is a very different thing, just sort of one-to-one. And then sort of pre-theory, we define empathy as standing in another's shoes. But when we break that down a little bit, it can mean different things. So it can mean, how would this feel for me to experience what you're experiencing? And then how would this feel for you to experience what you're experiencing? So when we think about it a little bit further, it can mean different things.
And can
the environment
we live in, the world around us, the things that we live each day, can that impact our view of empathy?
Yes, for sure. You know, I spent a lot of time for this book in South Africa, and there people were defining empathy as an interruption of power, which is a very different notion of empathy than, for example, we have here. And there, for example, there was a man who was an architect of apartheid, a man named Eugene de Kock, and he was being released from prison on parole after committing gross crimes against humanity, and that would never be considered here. And they were doing it because he had basically expressed remorse. And the idea was, if we express empathy toward this human being, it sort of undercuts some of his power. It's an expression of interrupting his power. And that's a really different idea of empathy than we have culturally here.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting you bring up South Africa, because they're currently in 10 days of national mourning for Winnie Mandela, who died Monday, the anti-apartheid activist.
Right.
You write about empathy then as it relates to South Africa and apartheid, especially as you saw it from a college campus. What did you learn there?
It was really interesting. I was at a university, at the University of Bloemfontein, at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein. And Bloemfontein is kind of like, if you're in South Africa, it's kind of like going to, it's like going to Nebraska or something. It's like very middle of the country, very middle of the road politically. There they have an institute for trauma and reconciliation. It's run by one of the original members of the TRC, and I went to study with her. Her name is Pumukabodo Madikizela. Her family is connected to, actually, Winnie Mandela, who's also a Madikizela. What they had done there that was very, very interesting, which, again, is something that we wouldn't do here, was they had just integrated their residences. So in South Africa, they have a mandate that 70% of the university population is black, but they hadn't mandated that the that the residencies be integrated. So the residences were, so the dorms, what they call residences, were primarily split and divided by race. And so they had just become integrated, and there a terribly, terribly racist, violent video came out on the that white students had put out, and it went viral. It went international. And what we would have done in the States would have been to punish the students that did it and kick them out of the school. Well, what they did in the university there was the president said, these students are not bad apples. These students are products of all of us. And therefore, we have to welcome them back into the school, and we have to think about what were the conditions under which these students made this video, and who are we to have created these students? We are all complicit in this. And that's a form of empathy that is very different than we see operating here, where we want to externalize and blame the other.
Yeah, making much more of a community approach as well, yeah. Drawing people in.
Right. Very, very interesting. So I watched that happen, that kind of approach happen again and again, but I watched it at a very specific kind of individual level at this university where I was. So I was really interested in that.
Can we go personal here for a moment? Talk about why you went on this journey to find empathy, to understand empathy, because through this process, you really found yourself along the way.
Yeah, you know, originally when I first started the book, I didn't think it was going to be a personal journey. I thought that I was really just looking at a surge in all things empathy. I noticed that there was mirror neurons were exploding at the time, and there was a lot of research into sort of the neurobiological underpinnings of empathy. There was empathy being taught in the schools, so I was really curious about that. Businesses were promoting empathy. I was like, what was going on with that? So I thought that I was just doing a sort of cultural look. And at the time, I thought, well, I don't have anything personal to say about it. I actually kind of poo-pooed self-empathy as sort of one more chain in a long chain of selfishness. I thought self-empathy was sort of just another narcissistic trait in American narcissism. And then I went through a very personal crisis. My partner of 10 years suddenly became physically violent and left me in a big storm, and I had to. My life went and turned flipped upside down, and I didn't know, all my old tools suddenly didn't serve me anymore. And my tools of just work hard and push through and, you know, don't think very deeply about your feelings, didn't work. And I suddenly had to turn to a kind of self-empathy, which was really surprising in the middle of this project. I had to suddenly be kind to myself. In order to get through that crisis. And so I learned that self-empathy is kind of a root of understanding others, actually.
So you had to learn more about yourself before you could truly understand what empathy is or isn't.
Yeah, I really did. And I went to a couple of courses on self-empathy, and I really learned that it is a valuable and important tool.
Her new book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Chris Beam is with us. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How would you define empathy? How do you make room for it in your own life? Is empathy something we can or should teach? Do you think we could all stand to have a bit more empathy? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Chris, let's look a little bit about society, corporate America, its approach to empathy. Early in your book, you write about how empathy seems to be developing into this buzzword with companies employing, empathy branding strategies. Is that cheapening the path we think about empathy and how we approach it?
Yeah, I do. I think it is. There's something called empathic branding and empathic marketing, and these are things, empathy is being really taught in business schools now, and I think it's more than a bastardization of a term, and I'll explain why, but What they mean by empathy when business schools are talking about it is when you are shopping for dog food online and a story about a dog shows up in your newsfeed in the next moment, they call that empathy. They call that understanding you as a consumer, because no longer are we, I mean, this is no big news, but no longer are the companies pushing the large commercial for a million people. They're doing one-to-one marketing. That's how they're selling their products. And so they're really targeting the individual, and they're trying to understand the individual. But I think that there's something sort of deeper afoot than just branding to us. I think that we, as the consumer, start to feel empathized with. We start to feel more than marketed to. We start to feel like our online experience, where we spend more and more of our days, is a totally curated, totally self-oriented place to be. And we start to feel like we could and should be empathized with at all times. Our whole online life should be made to feel very comfortable. And I wonder about that, and I worry about that. And one of the things that I question.
Yeah. When you talk about empathic marketing, on the backside of that, there's technology in a lot of it. And we talk about machine learning, the coding that makes the technology on the front end possible to know that you want some dog food. Where does empathy come in technology?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. There are more and more, you know, just this past year, there were some 150 patents for, say, facial recognition software. So software that will recognize as you're going through as you're scrolling through your news feeds, recognize when you have micro expressions of pleasure or displeasure. So when you notice a story on a marriage that's gone awry, and you express consternation, then they can quickly send you an ad for marriage counseling. This is just a small example. But we're going to slowly see more and more of this, where the machines are reading our expressions and trying to guess at what it is we want or need. And we're going to feel more and more like this is normal, that we should be catered to, that all of our expressions should be understood at a micro level and felt, and it's going to feel more like that's a felt experience, and that we should be tended to at all times. I wonder about that, yeah.
Yeah. There are a couple ways to look at empathy. Is it active, like something we do, or is it something we are? We're exploring the inner workings of empathy in America with author Chris Beam. Her new book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How would you define empathy? How do you make room for it in your own life? Is empathy something that we can or should teach? Where do you see it in action? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Talking about the cultural impact, the cultural implications of empathy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're hearing about schools teaching empathy. We hear about empathy being a marketable skill, like something you want to have working in the tech or the business world. Looking at the many layers that is empathy, a word that is 100 years old, writer and professor Chris Beam stays with us. Her new book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where do you see empathy at work in your world? Where do you see a need for it? How do you define it? And can it be learned, or is it inherent? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joe in Oshkosh couldn't stay with us, but Chris, he wanted to ask you if you think whether empathy is something that is inherent to humans or if it is socialized.
That's a great question, and thank you for that. I think it's both. I think it's something that, you know, we talk about babies out of the womb. There's a developmental psychologist named Martin Hoffman who traced the way that we develop empathy in babies. And in the first year, there's the lowest level, which is mirroring. So we see in babies that they, you know, when a baby cries, another baby will cry. And when a baby yawns, another baby will yawn. So there's something definitely inherent in that. And then in the year second, in the second year, we see a kind of egocentric empathy, which is that you recognize other people have feelings, but you think that they're the same as yours. So you, when a 2-year-old sees another baby crying, they will maybe hand them their stuffy because they think that that's what they need, because they expect that they're the same. In the third year, you recognize that people can have different feelings than your own. And then as you get older, you start to recognize that people can have different life circumstances than your own. So developmentally, we shift, and I think that these things are inherent. But what we do with these feelings or these experiences is cultural. So it's both. We learn how to empathize in a sort of deeper, more nuanced way. So in other words, there's a kind of low-level empathy that is inherent, and then there's a higher-level empathy, which may be imaginatively being able to step into another person's experience, which is maybe modeled. And that happens from the culture around us.
Chris, you explored this notion that empathy has been weaponized in the wake of the 2016 presidential election. How so? Can you go into that for us?
Well, you know, we saw that a lot. We saw that the word empathy was used a lot in the wake of the election. People were saying, "I'm not going to have empathy for the other side because they don't have empathy for me." And I thought that that was really interesting, that it was that people would choose to say, "I'm not going to feel something that is sort of that is like, as Joe the caller said, it suggested that it might be an inherent experience. Like, I'm going to turn off something that is almost automatic, and that would be a way to confront another somebody that we perceive as dangerous." And I'm not sure that that's useful. I'm not sure that choosing to be unempathetic is a way to move forward when you disagree with someone.
It's also come up a lot in the Trump administration and the way President Trump is using tweets.
Right, right. He's certainly... We have, I mean, it's very interesting. If we look at culture from a top-down sort of model, we're certainly experiencing culturally a less empathic culture right now. We've got a very bigoted and cruel and narcissistic kind of system that's happening. And
But some people... Yeah, and I think the threshold that people have can be pretty wide and varying there as to whether these specific traits or these tweets have the intentions that they serve, that some people can be more impacted than others.
Right. You mean by the experience, how hard they are? How
sure, yeah, but yeah, because each experience is unique.
Right, right. I mean, we found that, you know, some people are the impact of cruelty is different for each person. I mean, there have been many, many studies on highly sensitive people, the HSPs, that show that there are those that are very, very that are highly impacted they're just more sensitive to all things, to light, to sound, to color, to touch. And so they're definitely more impacted by harsh words. So yeah, definitely.
I didn't know HSPs had their own acronym.
They have their own acronym now.
We're talking with Chris Beam. Her book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy, exploring the layers of empathy, where it comes from. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think empathy can be taught? Do you think it's something we should teach our kids in school, curriculums for empathy? Do you have a story about how someone else's empathy for you has made your life better, or perhaps moved in another direction? Do you think empathy's not at all cracked up to what it should be? 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. So, Chris Beam, you had made mention that empathy as a word, it has only been around for 100 years. Where does it come from?
It comes from the word Einfühlung, which is a German word. It means feeling into. It was originally an aesthetic concept, which essentially meant, an artistic or an aesthetic concept, which was about the way that we experience art. And it meant the way that we felt into art was a way that we felt it in our bodies. So say we see something like a Doric column. We don't just think about that Doric column. We experience the Doric column internally. We sort of straighten up a little inside. We feel that straightening of the column. And that feeling into notion spread into all kinds of fields. Freud used it in psychology, and the notion of empathy became very popular at the end of the 19th century into the 20th. So, it's not really the first time, though, I want to be careful around this, that it was the first time that empathy as a word was coined, but 200 years ago, Adam Smith and David Hume were using the word sympathy much the way that we use the word empathy today. Hume wrote about mirroring as an essential human trait, and Smith said that sympathy required both imagination and understanding. So they were using sympathy in the way that we use the word empathy. But we've had these sort of swings toward empathy in every 100 years or so, where in between them we had sort of more egoist philosophies, people like Hobbes and Rousseau with their Savage Man, and later in another swing, Nietzsche and his Superhuman. So we swing between these poles of the individual self-centered philosophy that say whether we're all just sort of self-interested beasts toward ones that say that we're more interconnected. And I think that we're in a more interconnected kind of phase right now where we're interested in all things empathy, and then we'll swing back out of it into a more sort of self-centered kind of ideology.
Oh, so there's ebb and flow here a little bit,
right.
Trends,
right.
Over decades, over time.
Yeah, exactly. That's what my research seems to suggest. That's what I've seemed to see.
Let's bring in Dave now. Dave in Madison has a question. Hi, Dave.
Hi. So I'm a psychologist, and I'm very interested in empathy, how it can be taught, and what happens in the brain. So when I look at the literature, what I see is that there is not a lot of evidence that empathy can be taught very well. And the other thing I've found is that from looking at Karen Tinker's work, Karen Tinker is a primary researcher in empathy. She works in Germany at the Max Planck Institute. And she has found that different parts of the brain are lit up for empathy or compassion. And so she's learned to define that empathy is when you feel bad, but compassion is when you want to do something about people feeling bad. So compassion has a much more active element. You can be empathic and not really do anything about someone else's pain or suffering. But when you're compassionate, the different part of the brain lights up that says, oh, I really want to help them. I want to help take care of them. I want them to feel less bad. And so I'm going to do something about that. And I'm wondering if your speaker can comment on these things.
Dave, thanks so much. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I've read some of the same research, and we talk about empathy fatigue, and people have suggested that compassion, people that feel a lot of compassion don't feel the same fatigue, because compassion does have that element of action to it. Same with sympathy. Sympathy also has the notion of an action that's coupled with it, whereas empathy is merely the act of experiencing another person's experience, or feeling another person's feelings. It doesn't have that component of taking an action to relieve the suffering. I think you're absolutely right. I think that that it doesn't have the same... they don't operate necessarily in the same parts of the brain. It's just an experiential mode. That's all that empathy is. It doesn't have the element of action.
Well, Dave also brought up this point that it can't be taught very well, but we've seen signs of it, like Sesame Street is teaching empathy through its programming. They rolled out a whole season around that theme. Elementary schools are trying to teach empathy. So where is the disconnect there?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there are a lot, many schools are pushing empathy in their curriculum. And part of it is to counter the bullying that's going on. And there's a lot of work being done in anti-bullying and a lot of pressure at the state level to counter bullying. And some mandates around that. So they think that teaching empathy is a way to handle that. But I agree with Dave that it can't be taught. And I think that there are some problems around thinking of empathy as a gradable, numeratizable kind of skill set. I think that when we think about it that way, it becomes yet another acquisitional kind of thing that we can acquire and master. And when students feel like, oh, this is another thing that I should learn because I'm going to be graded on it, something like a skill, like learning the piano is a skill, it loses its inherent value.
And I wonder if it's too early to know if those curriculums really work, really pan out in adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a couple of interesting empathy programs that I think are worth mentioning. There's one called Roots of Empathy, where they bring it. This is primarily in Canada. It's just starting to make inroads in the United States. It's in Canada and in many places in Europe, just beginning to come to the U.S. And what they do is they bring a baby into a classroom over 9 months. And so the same baby with a caregiver, parent usually, will come into the classroom every 2 weeks, so say a fourth grade classroom or a third grade classroom, and the children get to watch the baby's growth over 9 months and get to know the baby and watch the baby have experiences, watch the baby cry, watch the baby, you know, tease, watch the baby, whatever. The baby is usually about, you know, starts at about 9 or 10 months and then grows up a little bit. And the children get to then develop a sort of emotional vocabulary around watching this baby. And so when the baby feels sad, the kids get to talk about their own sadness and their own times that they might have, they get to imagine what the baby's feeling, and then they get to imagine what they might have felt at times when they were young. And this is a sort of modeling rather than a modeling of empathy, rather than telling the kids how to behave empathically, which I think is a more useful sort of model for quote-unquote teaching empathy.
You were talking earlier kind of this gray area between empathy and sympathy and just the back and forth with those two words. What about empathy and compassion? What are the differences there?
Yeah, I think that the caller mentioned it earlier. I think that the difference between empathy and compassion is that compassion has an element of action to it. Compassion is usually feeling a little bit of sorrow. There's a feeling to it. Empathy is not a feeling. Empathy is is a mode. Empathy is a way of experiencing someone else's feelings or experience. That's all it is. Whereas compassion is usually feeling some kind of sorrow for someone's experience. So you add a feeling tone to it. And then there's an element of proactiveness. You want to alleviate. There's a desire to alleviate that person's suffering. Whereas empathy doesn't have any of that. Empathy is merely just experiencing the other person's experience. That's it. It's a precursor. It's a precursor for many things. It's a precursor for citizenship or justice or forgiveness. It's a precursor for, it's a hinge for many, many, many important things. But it isn't those things in and of themselves.
Let's bring in Janet now in Madison. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I've heard of children learning empathy and compassion via reading. Obviously, they're experiencing the characters and what those characters are going through. So I'm wondering what your guest knows about that. And I'm also wondering if that can help adults improve on their empathy and compassion by reading. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about Canada there, but can reading help with empathy and the books that teachers choose?
Yes, I think that's a great question. I think art has always been the primary avenue to empathy. There have been studies that show that reading in particular up our levels of empathy. So they do test on people before they've read literary fiction and then after they've done literary fiction and then self-reported levels of empathy. So how much do they feel another person's pain or when they see the hands being pricked, for example. And then they also have done fMRI studies where they measure blood flow to the brain when that person watches somebody's hand being pricked. And the blood flow level increases after they've read literary fiction. So these are pretty rudimentary tests, but they're still showing an increase. And in some ways it's kind of obvious, yes, that when we read, it's the gateway drug. You know, it's the way that we feel another person's feelings. And that's been true since the dawn of arts. It's the way that we understand the other. And thank goodness for it. That's the way that we, that's the, maybe the primary and the best way for us to understand each other is through art. That's one of my main arguments. So thank you for that question. I think it's really important.
Let's bring in Kara Lee from Seymour with thoughts on this. Kara Lee, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was, you know, hearing that the window to catch empathy, in my opinion, is caught first and then taught. And that window is very small. It starts in early childhood, babies. When babies are together and one baby is unhappy, hungry, frustrated, whatever, and begins to cry, other babies around it begin to cry too, almost like a group sorrow. And in early childhood, a baby observes parents who demonstrate empathy, and they catch it, and that can be developed. One concern that I have is already they have to teach empathy in elementary school. That means the children have lost that. And I think part of that is the programming, even PBS programming for children, because there's an awful lot of subliminal and obvious violence in those where, you know, people that are supposed to be friends laugh at each other when they get in trouble or have a problem. And you know, it's almost like the society, the culture is teaching with a forked tongue.
Carol,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, just thank you so much for bringing that up and this idea of catching empathy. Chris Beam, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that that's a really sort of beautiful
a beautiful depiction of what might happen, that, you know, so much of empathy is experienced rather than taught. And we experience it very early. And when we're empathized with at a young age, we learn then to empathize with others. I think your point about witnessing real cruelty, like violence and mockery in our programming that's around us, is a tough thing to counter. I think that's a really good point. And so I think it's not just, I think one of the dangers of teaching empathy in the schools is not necessarily a bad thing to teach it in the schools, but it's a bad thing when we shrug our shoulders and go, okay, good, it's being taught, my job is done. Because we have so much to counter in our society that it's not enough to just give it a lesson plan in classroom. We need to be modeling empathy all the time because, as this caller said, we're being flooded with images of non-empathic action all the time.
We're exploring how empathy functions in our society, in our daily life, why people try to cultivate it as a skill. The new book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Chris Beam is an assistant professor of English at William Patterson University. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. How do you see empathy at work in your own life? Can it be taught? Were you taught? And where do you see it today? Less of it, more of it? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Author Chris Beam writes that her two favorite definitions of empathy are an interruption of power and mutual vulnerability. Both definitions call upon an aspect of loving, and it's a chicken or the egg dilemma. It's unclear which came first, the empathy or the love. We're talking about the complexities of empathy in our culture today in America. Chris Beam's book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. And you can join in, 800-642-1234. Is our society, our humanity, moving on a path toward being more empathic or love-based society? Where are you seeing it? What are you doing in your day-to-day life, your interactions with loved ones, in your workplace? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Heather emailed, said, I've had a challenging time with empathy for a long time. She says, I pick up on others' feelings, and it can make for awkward situations. At a funeral for someone I barely know, I will be overcome. I've heard my whole life, you're just too sensitive. She says, it drives me nuts. And also, it can be hard because you forget the other people aren't like you. And it's frustrating because you have an expectation of other people to have more compassion. And this leads to a lot of disappointment. Can you respond, Chris, to Heather there?
Yeah. So it's very interesting, the idea of people that have, quote, too much empathy. I think we need to have empathy for these people because it's, again, that idea of the highly sensitive person, that there are people that have that are just highly tuned in and pick up a lot of the feelings. And it's difficult to move through the world like that. We're all on a continuum here, and at the high end are people like Heather, and at the low end are the sociopaths. And we're starting to see that in
there's a man named Kent Keel who's done some really interesting brain scans of criminal sociopaths and found that some pretty significant real estate, neural real estate, is atrophied in people that don't have empathy. Now, whether it's causal, we don't know, or whether it's, you know, it comes from the experiences that they've had. But we are seeing different brain patterning in people that have no empathy to people that have high levels of empathy. So there is some biological basis for this. And I think we just need to understand that we're on a range. Mm-hmm. We're all on a range there.
Break down for us where you go with this notion of mutual vulnerability and interruption of power playing into empathy.
Well, you know, I think pre-theory, we think of empathy as just standing in another's shoes. And there's a person named Nell Noddings who says that the whole notion of projecting yourself into another person's experience is a particularly Western masculine notion of empathy. And she says, you know, slow down on that. Let's not project all the time. She says the whole idea of empathy is receptivity. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought that's actually useful. Let's just think that empathy is mutual vulnerability. Let's just both be mutually vulnerable instead of constantly trying to project. Because again, that idea of projecting can be a colonizing move. Because when you do that, how would it feel for you to experience what you're experiencing? I'm sort of erasing or colonizing you. I'm swallowing up your agency. So I like the idea of just receiving, of just doing the receptivity.
But doesn't that involve a lot of trust there?
It does involve a lot of trust. That's an interesting question. It does involve a lot of trust. Just listening, just trying to listen. You know, there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that I reported on in the book here in Maine. And it was based on the 5 Wabanaki tribes and the state of Maine. And the tribes had been, the state had removed tribal children and put them into white families up until 1980, which defied the Indian Child Welfare Act, which passed in 1972, which said that, you know, no longer could they do that. And there was a lot of pain and a lot of resentment and a lot of bitterness and a lot of anger to sort through. And so the idea was to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for 2 years where the two sides could talk about this and air their grievances. And what they found was they couldn't just contain it to the tribes and the government agencies. They had to involve the entire state of Maine and had to talk about going all the way back to colonization because the ideas were so big. And they had to do a lot of listening. And when I talked with the tribal leaders, they said, you know, our way of listening and our way of empathizing in this process is very different. When we listen to one another, like they didn't, let me back up a little bit. The TRC was set up very differently than the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, where perpetrators and victims faced each other one-on-one, faced each other one-to-one in a face-off kind of way. In the TRC in Maine, the Native people did just talk to one another. They didn't want to face the government folks. They wanted to just talk to one another because they had a different way of listening, they said. And the way that they listened was to listen with a way of thinking, I'm just listening to you and thinking about your innate goodness. And that's a very different way of listening than the way of empathy that we traditionally think of, which is, let me empathize with you and imagine you in your experience and imagine how I might feel in my experience of it and like this feedback loop. It's very different to just listen to somebody and say, I'm listening to you and imagining your innate goodness. I'm listening and imagining your innate goodness. So there, different qualities of, or different approaches to the way that we listen to one another. And I learned that in this book. I learned through these various projects of reporting that there are very different ways of listening. So this one of mutual vulnerability is very, very, very interesting to me.
So this might take us to the word forgiveness. Do you see a relationship then between empathy and forgiveness?
Yeah, forgiveness is really complicated. I do. I think empathy is a step toward forgiveness. I think that empathy is maybe inherent to forgiveness, but it's not all of forgiveness. I think that, forgiveness, some people say, is the idea of forgiveness is mourning the loss of revenge, which is an interesting idea.
Mourning the loss of revenge.
Yeah. Isn't that an interesting definition?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So in order to forgive, you've got to let go of the idea of getting even. And so empathy is a part of that. Empathy is a way to first understand the other person's experience. You're no longer seeing the other person as a bad other. You're seeing them more holistically.
Getting back to earlier in the conversation where you see the ebb and flow of empathy in our world, looking forward in your crystal ball, where are we going with empathy?
It's very hard to think in a meta way. But again, the idea of it depends on if you look at culture from the bottom up or the top down. If we look from the top down and we look at this culture from the view of the Trump administration and where we're heading that in that way, it looks very, very grim. When we look at the top-down model, we're facing more cuts to the arts, which make us more empathic, and we have this leadership that's very greedy and self-obsessed and dangerous and violent. It looks very grim. On the other hand, we've got this younger generation that cares more about social issues than ever before and is more generous toward issues like LGBTQ+ people and immigration. And so from the bottom up, it looks really hopeful. It looks more empathic. So I think it's really hard to get a meta handle on these things, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we are becoming more empathic.
Well, as we start to wrap up here in the last few seconds, if we could do one thing each day to add a little more empathy in our day-to-day lives, what would that be? What would that look like?
That's a great question. What would it be to add one more thing? I think the thing that I would do is think about empathy as being receptive, as receptivity, as rather than standing in another's shoes, it's shifting your mindset to being receptive to another person's experience, to just opening yourself up to what another person experiences or goes through, and just widening the lens on that.
Chris, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Beam is an assistant professor of English at William Patterson University. Her newest book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer.